Just, I know I didn't talk about everything on the bibliography, but I did talk a little bit about the first section, Middle East, on the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict. David Shipler's book, I mean, just the title gives away his, I think, sensitivities. Arab and Jew, Wounded Spirits in a Promised Land. Says a lot, and it's now updated. It was written quite a few years ago, but it's really about the underlying experiences and history of the two peoples, the Palestinian Arabs and the Jewish people, and how that relates to the conflict. So it's, and it was, as I said, it was updated just last year. And then Jimmy Carter, of course, a hero of working for peace. And that's his most recent book, We Can Have Peace, A Plan That Will Work. You know, he wrote a book where he used apartheid in the title, which caused a huge furor. And I think the furor was well deserved in the sense that I've read the book, and there are several places where someone should have said, Jimmy, do you really mean this? You know, sincerity and good intention doesn't carry you all the way to clarity and wisdom on an issue as complicated and sensitive as this one. Because apartheid, certainly if Israel keeps control of the West Bank and Gaza and doesn't allow Palestinians to vote anywhere or in those areas, that's apartheid. It's a little bit more complex to say that the whole situation is apartheid because white South Africans never had a connection to the land of South Africa that Jews have to the Holy Land. And so it's sort of like the comparison with, oh, it's just like the situation with Native Americans and Europeans. You know, we came and took their land, and the Jews came and took the Palestinians' land. Well, that much is true, but then you have to look at the fact that that Europeans had no connection with this land at all, where Jews have a deep, bone-deep sense of connection to the Holy Land over centuries. And some people will say, you know, how can they remember that long? And Jews might say, how can you forget? So anyway, Jimmy got in trouble for that one, but his more recent one, I think, is more solid, and much of the book with apartheid in the title is also solid. Tom Friedman, you probably know his name from the New York Times, his book, it's also an old book, but it's popular and it's interesting. I sometimes find Tom Friedman more clever than wise. I mean, he's always looking for an angle, you know, to do his column with, and sometimes the angle proves to be a road to wisdom, and sometimes it's just an angle to his cleverness. The next one you probably don't know, but it's a very interesting book by Todd Gitlin, who was one of the founders of the Students for Democratic Society and Occupy, and Leila Leibovitz, Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election. You get it. I mean, both America and Israel have this idea that we're chosen. Early writings in American history, you know, have that aspect to where a city set on a hill. Well, that's a complicated thing, you know, a sort of God-ordained place. Woo. It's a little tricky because we know that any people make big mistakes, do awful things, and was that God-ordained too? Dan Kurtzer, I mentioned his name, this is the ambassador friend of ours, and his writing on the Arab-Israeli conflict is quite significant. Senator Mitchell described this book as really the best, most insightful book about what needs to go on in negotiations. And then Uri Sevier, I put this in because, you know, we sometimes think of Israelis and Palestinians fighting, not each having their own self-absorbed view of the conflict. Uri Sevier was the chief Israeli negotiator in Oslo, along with Abu Awla, the Palestinian, and this is a book about the process of their getting, of the two teams interacting in Oslo. And it's really incredible because it's about the politics of the interaction, but at a deeper and some ways even more interesting level, it's about the human interactions that went on in Oslo. And how people began to open to each other. as they, you know, for instance, had time over dinner to ask, well, are you married? Do you have children? What do they do, you know? And you began to see connections to the other that you hadn't imagined before. In fact, you probably couldn't have imagined before you were sitting at dinner and talking about your kids. So anyway, Uri Sevier's book. And you know, you can fault me for a number of these being dated, but so am I. So there's a connection, you know. There are two new books that are fascinating. One by a man named Robert something, who was the chief UN participant in negotiations over several years, so representing the Secretary General. You can find that if you look around for UN negotiator Israeli-Palestinian, you'll find that book. And then there's another book that's just come out, The Only Thing They Understand, and it's by a very interesting, very knowledgeable person who says the only thing that the two sides understand is force. And if there's going to be peace, somebody has to make them do it. Well, that's an interesting idea that I'll bet you'd get kickback from both sides. There's a certain truth in it, but also a certain lack of, what should I say, nuance? Anyway, so today is... The subject is Islam, American Muslims, Islamophobia. I want to begin just with these words, which are the words that begin every chapter but one in the Quran, and don't ask me why the one doesn't have these words at the beginning, I forget. There's some sort of simple practical explanation of some sort, it's not a big theological question, but every chapter, every surah of the Quran begins with these words, Bismillah, Al-Rahman, Al-Rahim, which one English translation, a decent one, is in the name of God, the merciful to all, the mercy giver. Another translation of it is in the name of God, the one who does mercy, and obviously when you say that, there's choice involved, and who is mercy, no choice at all, in the very nature of God, is mercy. And if we know anything about ourselves as human beings, we can say, thank God for that. And it's certainly part of the Lutheran, central Lutheran message. Where would we be without God's mercy or God's grace? So these words begin every chapter of the Quran. And, you know, in talking with people about Islam, this is a good reference, because how is it that then people do the things they do in the name of Islam? Well, we can do the same thing taking gospel passages and say, well, how could Christians possibly have done that in the name of Christ? As, for instance, Franklin Graham thought that the invasion and occupation of Iraq was a Christian act, based on Christian teachings. Well, I want to pass around something that wasn't in the packet. Somebody would help, or a couple people could help, just get this around. Probably not enough for everybody, but share. This is something called a common word between you and us. And it's a Muslim initiative in about, I think, 2006, it's several years back, where 138 Muslim scholars from all over the world, every country you can name where there are Muslims, signed a letter to Christians all around the world saying that we share a deep belief in two things. Love of God as preeminent and singular, above all else, love of God, honor of God, and love of neighbor. Interesting that Muslims, in their understanding, these are Muslim scholars, in their understanding of Islam, said those are the two things. And of course then, there was a Christian response signed by, the Muslim response initially, the Muslim letter was signed by 138 scholars from all around the world. I think now the number of signers is up to 200. And they include scholars from countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, where some of what goes on in the name of Islam is certainly not of a kind that we could say is helpful to peace building in the world. So it's interesting that these scholars agreed, but you know, scholars can agree and people can do what they want to do. And then there's a Christian response, and in the document that you now have in your hand, you'll see that there's references at the end of each, the Muslim letter and the Christian response, to the source for that those documents, which are more lengthy and include signatures. I mean, it would be interesting just to look at what Christian scholars signed the Christian response to the Muslims. And it's an important thing because it says that at the level of the sort of most respected prominent scholars around the world, both Muslim and Christian, there's a sense of the timeliness and urgency to talk with each other. And one of the ways they put it is, there are a billion of you and a billion of us. If we don't get along, the world's in trouble, which is a simple thing, but it's real when you're talking about a billion people. So knowing more about Islam, and again, here I reference the bibliography, if you still have it handy, knowing more about Islam as a religious tradition is very important, and there's work to be done by all of us about that. I don't know how many of us have read the Quran. It's not an easy, okay? It's not an easy document to read, and it's ordered in an odd way from the longest to the shortest chapter, or is it from the shortest to the longest? It's one or the other, which is an odd way to order a sacred text, but that's the way it's ordered. And there are many passages which, if you're not confused by them, you're probably not reading them because there's some confusion. But, you know, if you've read through the Hebrew scripture, aren't there places there where you get stuck and say, what is that about, you know? The gospel, a little bit clearer, but then there's a lot of arguments about what this sentence means or that sentence means. So reading the Quran is one exercise, and I point to the first thing on the first item on the bibliography there under Islam. There is a brand new study Quran out by a very highly respected scholar, Sayyid Nasser, who teaches at Georgetown University, and it's a new translation of the Quran, and that even that word is interesting because it used to be you didn't say translation, you'd say interpretation, because if Muhammad received the revelation from the mouth of God, then the words he received the revelation in are the words of God, which of course is a little odd. Was God an Arab? Did God speak Arabic? Well, you know, already you've got a kind of a problem there in terms of how do you understand that. In any case, this is a new translation and a commentary. So it's a study Quran, which is, I mean, it sort of suggests that you're not just going to get the Quran, period. You're going to get some commentary, some questions, and so forth. And then the next one you might find particularly interesting, and it's also very new, 2016, the Quran with references to the Bible. So here's a text of the Quran with footnotes all through that refer to texts in the Hebrew scripture or Old Testament and the Gospel, which relate subject matter or theme or point that being made, etc. And that's an interesting thing to study because these are fat books, so you probably don't like just read through them, but you might look up particular passages in the Quran which you've been troubled by, or somebody has said, well, yeah, did you hear that the Quran says this? Look it up and see something about what its context is, what any references to Christian scripture. The next book, this is a marvelous man by the name of F.E. Peters. He taught at NYU. I had the privilege of having him on a delegation that I led to the Middle East. So, boy, when we came up against scholarly questions or questions about texts, this guy knew it all. He's got a three-volume work looking at themes in Jewish, Christian, and Muslim texts, and looking at them together. For instance, the theme of sacredness, sacred. And so he looks in each tradition, how is that theme treated in the text? So, but that's a three-volume work. It's well worth looking at, getting from the library maybe. He's also written a wonderful biography of the Prophet Muhammad. This is his most accessible, popular book, entitled The Children of Abraham, about Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The next one is a collection of essays, and it's interesting in terms of the place of American Muslims in American society and some of the complications of that, some of the divergences of that, some of the realities of that in terms of where people have come from and when they immigrated to the United States and what experience they may have left behind or fled from. And then there's a Lutheran book out about experiences that American Muslims and Christians are having with each other, which is there in the title, Engaging Others, Knowing Ourselves. Then there's Imam Faisal. You may know his name, or if you don't know his name, you probably know something about him. He's the man that was involved in the project to build an interfaith tower near to where Ground Zero was. And of course, it was very controversial because people said you're desecrating, to have anything Muslim near the site of Ground Zero is desecrating this ground, and it's an outrage, and we should stop it. Well, it's going forward slowly, and da-da-da. We'll see what happens. He's an interesting person, and his book, looking at Islamic teachings and teachings basically of American values and American law and how they relate to each other. Tariq Ramadan is the most well-known and popular European Muslim scholar dealing with a lot of the situation of Muslims in Europe, and this is one of his books, In the Footsteps of the Prophet, Lessons from the Life of Muhammad. And then the last one is a book about Islamophobia, the fear of Islam. It's, you know, Islamophobia means more than the fear of Islam. It means really the hostile, the fear-based hatred of Islam and the actions which follow from that, some of which we probably have experienced. So knowing more about Islam is really important. But, you know, I think that probably even more important is knowing Muslims. And I thought if you were in some country in the Middle East or Africa, where Christians are a small minority, just think in your imagination for a minute the difference between a group of Muslims sitting in Syria or sitting in Yemen discussing Christianity versus the image of a group of Muslims in Yemen or Syria talking about Christians they know in their hometown. Think about how differently those conversations might go. I mean, the first easily becomes a kind of abstract either attack on or defense of Christianity, where the second, you're into the people. Well, you know, the baker in my town is a Christian. And I know him, and I know his wife, and I know his children. And our children play with them, and they, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm saying that knowing about Islam is important, but I think probably more important is knowing Muslims. And I'll just ask us, how many of us in this room know Muslim persons personally in any context? Great. At least half of us. I want for a few minutes just to hear, just to say, who you know, or with a name or not a name, but sort of the context in which you know them. Is it at work or in school or accidentally in travel? You know, how do you know them? And what would you say about them as a person? And if, and I say only if, because it isn't necessarily true that you'll be conscious of any way that their being Muslim affects how they are. I mean, how many Christians do you know where you say, oh, it's obviously his being a Lutheran that makes him that way? Well, you know, not necessarily. So just anyone start, someone you know who's a Muslim, and what would you say about them? Or how'd you meet him? Or, yeah.
Okay, well, this is probably unique, but our son married a Muslim and converted to Islam, and they have four daughters. And through them, of course, we've met many other Muslims. And they're, I mean, I may be biased, but they're wonderful people, generous, caring, taking care of their neighbor before themselves. If anybody needs anything, they will help them, even if it means they have to sacrifice something that they were saving money for or whatever.
Where is this, by the way? Say where.
Chicago.
Okay, Chicago. Say that also when you speak. Just, okay. Yeah.
And when I saw the rhythm of their day and how it's defined by the prayer times, and
yeah.
I mean, there's so much we can learn from them. Uh-huh. The way they, God is really first in their lives, and they really live that out.
So that's a comment on the last question I asked is, what do you perceive are ways that their being Muslim affects how they are? And you're saying the prayer, the discipline of the prayer is part of that.
Right.
Okay. Who else? Go ahead.
Ishmael Ahmed. He is an NPR radio DJ in Detroit.
Okay.
He's also a concert promoter and is instrumental in something that's actually coming up this next weekend. The Detroit area is called the Concert of Colors. He brings musical groups from around the globe to Detroit, and he encourages collaboration between musicians all over the country with the rich musical traditions of Detroit. And I'm blessed to be a part of that.
Oh.
He's a wonderful man, and he's all about collaboration. He does this all. When I think of Ish, I think of this.
I see. And I'm guessing is he. What's his background nationally? He's African American first?
No.
No, okay.
He's Arab, and honestly, I...
Arab, he's Arab American.
Arab.
Okay,
Arab. I don't know the specifics beyond that.
I may have, because the name Ishmael Reed, there's a poet or something, African American poet. Oh, that's great. Different story, and this is Detroit. Who else? Yeah.
Well, I know Ann Holmes Reddy in Seattle, who is an African-American woman, I think from a fairly prominent black family.
Uh-huh.
She became an Episcopal priest.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
And
yeah.
When her mother died, that was somehow instrumental in some of the words of Islam or music. It just struck such a chord with her that she didn't exactly convert to Islam. I guess she did.
Yeah.
But she also wanted to remain an Episcopalian priest.
Right.
And
the church, in its generosity, said,
well,
no.
No, that's right.
No, I'm teasing a little
anyway,
bit.
They had no problem with her being an Episcopalian and a Muslim.
Muslim, I see.
That was not the issue.
No, right.
The
right.
issue was they didn't quite see how she could continue to be acting as an Episcopal priest
with yeah.
the congregation,
yes.
and at the same time
being
a
Muslim. Yeah.
So
no,
in
that's,
the end,
that's,
she was, they call it defrocked.
Yes, yes.
You know?
Yes.
And now I know her because she is coming around to, or this is a few years ago,
yes.
coming around to Episcopal churches teaching
I see.
About Islam. And I kind of lost track of her
I see.
Since
okay.
Trump.
Okay.
But it's fascinating.
Well, you better find her because
she's a writer.
Yeah, no. I think some of us have heard that story in some version.
Perhaps. She spoke just a few months ago at our church.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Who else? And where, how did, yes, wait a minute.
I had a different and very moving experience a couple of years ago.
A little bit louder, or maybe just stand up and help you.
I had a different and very moving experience a couple of years ago in the hospital where I work in helping a Muslim family who were new immigrants with the arrangements for burial of their child who died.
I see.
And it was, yes, well, they
wow.
were very gracious.
Wow, yeah. Yes. I can't see you, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, I worked for Muslims for many years, and
you work for Muslims
with them.
Oh, with them. Okay.
Yeah. And, well, for them too. But I think two.
In
things,
what context?
I was a principal, and they were teachers.
I see. Okay.
But anyway, two things that struck me always were they were the ones that were always telling me the similarities between Christianity
and
Islam.
I see.
You know, and I would go, oh yeah, but they were the ones that always took the initiative. And two, and I don't know how to explain it, but when they were dealing with death, they had such a acceptance, I don't mean a fatalistic, but an acceptance of God and the journey and everything that was so much more to me, healthy and spiritual than at least my small experiences, you know, with that. And it was always very moving to me.
I see. And where is your story from? I mean,
Minneapolis.
Minneapolis. And where was your encounter in the back corner?
In Everett, Washington.
In Everett, Washington, of course. Mm-hmm. Neighbors. Who else?
May I just comment on what you said?
Yeah, sure.
The feeling about death. Muslims believe that your time, that God knows when you will die. And you really can't do anything about it. It's when it's time to die, it's time to die. And that, I think that leads to this acceptance.
Yeah, she's expressing it better than me. Fatalism kind of comes to mind, and yet I sort of see that as a
negative
term. Yeah, and theirs was not negative.
Who else? I mean, I don't know about you, but I mean, for me, as an American who's lived in Jordan, and we lived upstairs from a baker and a cleaner, both of whom were Muslim, and you know, just wonderful people. So it's not that I haven't had any experience, but each of these stories adds another experience that I can't get out of my mind, and helps me to feel a certain connection with that I didn't feel before. It adds to my sense of connectedness that I'm saying this for myself. Anyone else have a personal? Yes.
So this is a non-church, non-spiritual context, but
sure.
I'm at a secular university.
Where is it?
University of California, Davis.
Okay.
And we have Muslim students.
Uh-huh.
Both on our campus and other campuses.
Sure.
And I'm thinking of one woman in particular. She and her husband were both Turks.
Uh-huh.
Are Turks. And I think we miss the fact sometimes of how sort of incredibly similar they are to us in every possible way. I mean, fully secular. These are unlike all of us. These are brilliant people. I mean, one has a PhD from Caltech, and
I see.
The other one got a PhD from us, and they're teaching at major American universities, and
yeah,
and all that. But all that's sort of being compromised right now, in terms of the flow of people, I think.
What do you mean by it being compromised?
Well, I think it's tougher for people from Turkey to come over.
Oh, I see. Yeah, and
it's just getting more and more difficult to have those kinds of exchanges and that kind of traffic.
I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Generous, kind, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just started working at a new company in January, doing gene sequencing. Gene sequencing. I worked with Illumina. Mm-hmm. They do 23andMe and Ancestry.com. Have you heard of this thing?
Oh, yeah.
So there's a woman, she came into the company much sooner, and she was just an absolutely wonderful sponsor. She helped get me plugged into the culture of the organization, and she was an outspoken advocate and, you know, a real mentor and everything. And later on, I found out she was Muslim, and she had a real devotion to her family, and she apologized, you know, for things like, you know, I have so many, you know, so much family, I don't have time for a lot of, you know, time outside of work,
right.
And but then, you know, because I asked her for coffee or things like that,
right.
But, you know, I was very careful during Ramadan, you know, to be careful and mindful of respecting her needs to follow that while still working, you know, just the very important.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I don't, when you ask the question, do we know any, you know, Muslim people, I can't, and I don't know, not now, but growing up, I was a teenager.
Where?
In Seattle, just the north end of Seattle.
Okay.
My dad was in a Rotary Club, and then Foundation for International Understanding through students.
Okay.
And so a lot of, so he ended up either hosting or meeting a lot of foreign students coming to UW, and so some of them became good friends that we would have to our house.
A house, yeah.
And so, getting quickly to my point, two of them, one was from Iraq, one was from Iran.
I see.
And when I remember them, what they were like, only good memories of good association, good social interaction. Religion was not actually brought up. So I really don't know for sure, you know, what they thought of.
Right.
But But when I think about them and I think about our interaction in later decades with Iraq, the war,
right.
and Iran,
and Iran,
it doesn't mesh.
Yeah. Oh,
that's my point. You know, when I think of them and I think of what has gone on between our countries, it doesn't make sense.
I mean, you know, you said something very simple. You knew a Muslim from Iraq and a Muslim from Iran, and then when you think of our country's relationship with Iraq and Iran, it doesn't match up. Mm-hmm. That may be simple, but it's one of the most profound things I've heard here this week. And if we only had enough sense to follow it or to experience it and to say, if that's true, wait a minute about what we're about to do. And I thought of our talking last night about Vietnamese and Vietnamese experience. And how many of our young soldiers who went to fight in Vietnam knew a Vietnamese before? A pilot that I met who was a POW in Hanoi said he flew a fighter bomber off an aircraft carrier in the South China Sea, had never been in Vietnam or met a Vietnamese before he was shot down. So, you know, what a disadvantage in terms of what you're being asked to do and possibly have done to you, get killed, to not even have been in the country or know any of the people. I mean, maybe that's the only way we can allow ourselves to do those things.
Well, exactly.
I understand. I do.
Because I think the militaristic machine would say the opposite. They would say it's an advantage not to know.
Well, I understand that, and I just thank you for putting something so profound in such a direct, simple way. It didn't match up. Mm-hmm. There's been an issue in the Seattle area, actually in Mukilteo, where the Muslim community wants to build and is planning to build and will likely go ahead to build a mosque, and it became controversial. It was already sort of something, oh, really? A mosque in Mukilteo? A Mukilteo mosque? And a very angry Jewish guy who works as a Boeing subcontractor sent postcards to everybody in Mukilteo that were carefully worded, but ever so clear, raising a fear prospect about a mosque in Mukilteo. Well, this then became an issue, and our Congressman Larson got involved and wrote a piece in the paper about it and met with the Muslim community, and Point of Grace Lutheran Church got involved in hosting a meeting where we could talk about these things. And at the meeting, some people from one of the Islamophobic groups called Act for America came, and they were hammering away this and that. And there was a woman, Muslim, who spoke at the meeting. And after the meeting, I spoke with one of the men who had been rather protesting and not trusting. She had said in the course of the question and answer period, when something came up about, you know, Muslim threat to do violence, terrorist act or something, she said, let me be clear. She said, if I ever hear in our community someone talking in a way that seemed to have the prospect of their doing violence, publicly or privately, whatever, against anybody or against any institution or doing terrorism, she said, I would call the police immediately. And as I got talking with this man after the program, an Armenian, I discovered he was Armenian, which has a certain aspect to it. I mean, he knew about the genocide of Armenians by Turkish Muslims. So he had all that as background. And of course, it didn't come out when he was screaming. But it came out in our conversation, and it gave me a little pause to not be too argumentative too quickly, you know, to listen a little bit more. And what we were talking about is, I said, well, you heard what the woman said about if she heard of any threat of violence, she would call the police immediately, the Muslim woman. He said, but I don't believe her. And then he said, I have 3 Iranian Muslim friends. If they said that, I'd believe them immediately. And I looked at him and I smiled and I said, what's the difference? He said, well, I know them. And I thought, what a, you know, and he then smiled because it was a kind of moment where we we both got it, you know? We both got it, and it wasn't a question of my winning an argument over him, his argument, but a question of following some questions through in a way that all of a sudden we were both standing there saying, oh, what's the difference? I know them. I know my friends. I don't know this woman. And he said, I would trust, if my friend said they would call the police if they heard about Colin, he said, I would immediately trust that they would do that. So it was, a statement that maybe knowing Muslims might be actually more important even than knowing about Islam. Or maybe the way to know about Islam is to know some Muslims. Yes.
Yeah, two things. I'd be interested if he had any friends who became sort of neo-Nazis and radical, would he call the police and his Caucasian friends?
You mean the man I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, part of a conversation like this at the edge of a meeting, I felt so blessed that we wound up where we did. I didn't, you know, pursue it further. Maybe it's like my Selma story, you know, of getting to a certain point with the white Selma guy and not being willing to go on to talk about if his white daughter married a Negro. But we, you know, the conversation ended, there wasn't time. I mean, I think it's a good question. I don't know the answer.
I wonder, with regard to Mapatio.
Yes.
Has Tim Iman played any role in that? That's an aside.
I don't know. He's got enough bad things he's doing. He may have been too busy to get involved.
Yeah.
He may have been.
Bellevue is one of the most integrated cities, has the great minority population.
Right.
And it's interesting to watch and see how that's developing and getting along. You know, Microsoft, you know, they have people.
Sure. Oh, yeah, no. That's one of the Microsoft obviously is a combination of blessings and some problems, but that's one of the blessings that they bring. In fact, that's our younger son's work is involved in helping to get visas, the processing of visas for people coming in for those kind of, you know, on those kind of visas for work assignments. And
I have one comment.
Yep.
It might almost be easier to pick a commonality that you don't have any contention around. So, for example, my coworker example, you learn to trust each other through the work,
sure.
And then you find out something that's different.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Right? And it's like the same way gays have gotten more traction because everybody knew them as
right. It's sort of like, you know, I really like you. And you're gay?
Right. And you're Muslim.
Well, I know. That's what you were saying, Muslim. And I was just saying, no, I think that's true, that when we allow ourselves to know each other first as persons, then the add-on factor oftentimes is maybe just puzzling instead of awful. You know?
But in that context,
yes,
your friend that had the Muslim friends and or not your friend, but the Armenian,
yes,
you know, that didn't penetrate, right? The fact that he had Muslim friends. And so, I mean,
it had penetrated because he was as firm in saying that he would trust them in a moment if they said they.
But it didn't generalize.
No, it didn't generalize, but I think our encounter, you know, I'm not going to say he came to be a different person, but we both wound up smiling. We both wound up acknowledging that we had discovered something in the course of the conversation that may actually be more important than the arguments that we brought. That knowing somebody breaks down certain instinctive non-trust. Here are some, I'm going to run through these, some not widely known facts about Muslims. Muslims have been part of America since before independence. It's estimated, of course this is only an estimate, that 30% of slaves brought from Africa were Muslim. American Muslims fought in every U.S. war. More than 10,000 American Muslims serve today in the U.S. military. This is not in your, I don't think. No, this isn't, no, I mean, I wouldn't, anyway. Thomas Jefferson owned a Quran and mentioned Muslims in defining religious liberty in the United States. These are things you can check, you know, there's the Google device, which is marvelous if you don't use it too much and think it's actually Goggle, not Google, you know. The Supreme Court of the United States in 1935 honored the Prophet Muhammad as one of the 18 greatest lawgivers in history. And that, of course, relates to Sharia and all that, you know. I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting. I mean, and there's, again, worth checking. And anybody that finds that one of these isn't true, let me know so I don't keep reading them, you know. There are approximately 50,000 American Muslim medical doctors across the United States. One out of 18 medical doctors in the United States are Muslim. American Muslim women are the second most highly educated religious community in the U.S., probably next to Jewish women, that's my guess. But it's only a guess, I don't know. And they are as likely as American Muslim men, likely or more likely, to have a college degree. And many of them, of course, got them before they came to the United States. They got them in their own country. Five of the past individual Nobel Peace Prize winners, 42%, have been Muslims. According to studies, and this is like the Pew, this was mentioned by Jason yesterday in the NPR session, Pew Research Center has done a lot of interesting research on communities and on people, including on American Muslims. According to studies, American Muslims are the strongest opponents of military attacks against civilians, are the strongest opponents. So that compared to Christians wobble on that issue. You know, sort of maybe a little bit more acceptance of collateral damage. Studies show that American Muslims mostly share the same values and freedoms as other Americans. And then the last one, which sort of is a comeuppance, hate crimes against Muslims or those perceived as Muslims, like, for instance, yes, who?
The Sikhs,
exactly, because, yeah, right, Durbin, must be a Muslim. A Sikh washing his car on the outskirts or somewhere in Seattle area was attacked recently, and it wasn't a Muslim, it was a Sikh. Hate crimes against Muslims or those perceived as Muslims are at the highest level they've ever been, up by more than 50% in recent year, certainly since the beginning of the election campaigns. And then, you know, we have to think about Islamophobia. And I guess where I'd start is, have any of you experienced an incident of Islamophobia in your sort of daily work lives or campus lives where something has happened that you've been around or has observed or been not, I wouldn't say, participant in some sense? Has anyone had the experience of someone either talking hatefully about Muslims or acting hatefully?
Other than turning on Fox News?
Oh, well, yeah, no. Sorry, indirect. Well, the reason I think that's an interesting question, my guess is, if you asked an American Muslim, and even my guess is I'm more confident of this statement, if you asked an American Muslim woman, the percentage who have perceived or experienced directly a verbal or other sort of abusive and hateful act or remark, you would find the percentages are very high. And that's worth, you know, it's sort of like reminding ourselves that we're white in terms of black experiences and realizing that we don't have those experiences, but not because we're better or because we somehow they deserve them and we don't. It's just a matter that we're white and they're black. We're not Muslims, so it doesn't happen to us. I think I'm right about what I just said, that a substantial percentage, I don't know if it's a majority percentage or not, but a substantial percentage of American Muslim women, particularly, even more than Muslim men, have had an experience, an untoward experience, because they are Muslim and because they're women. I mean, you know, it's...
Because you can see them.
Well, exactly. It's partly because you can see because of certain dress things, wearing a scarf or wearing a more full covering, but it's also because they're women and therefore they're more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Therefore they're more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. The guy might punch you in the nose. Right. No, I mean, seriously. So you look at his size. You look at his size. You look how strong he is. You're much bigger. Now maybe you say something to him. But a woman, more vulnerable. So that's, and the fact that, you know, apparently none of us have had the direct experience of being involved in an incident like that, and if I'm right, that probably a substantial portion, no, I have no doubt about that, but maybe even a majority of American Muslim women have had some experience, even if it's just a look on a bus. Or a, yeah, go ahead.
I was just thinking about that incident in Portland,
mm-hmm.
where the women,
yeah.
The far-right guy who on the bus was attacked on the
yeah.
rapid transit was pulled a hajib and vilifying these
women. Yes.
And then some men came forward.
And intervened.
And intervened and were killed.
And were killed, yeah. Well, you know, we'll get to what we can do
yeah.
about Islamophobia in a few minutes. And that's a good caution. And we're killed. I don't mean that laughing at that situation. I mean just laughing. Oh, well, we'll take care of this, you know. Oh, but maybe not. Because there are things short of being killed that we don't like to experience. So maybe we'll just walk on.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll say, gee, that was awful what I saw today. But I didn't do anything to intervene. I didn't do it. Or my goodness, the guy I work with said Muslims want to take over our country, or they want Sharia to be the law of the land, or something like that. And I don't think that's true. But I didn't say anything. You know, how often do we?
That's always the case.
Well, of course. I mean, it's a lot of the times the case, and it's been true for years about us as whites with blacks. So
Germany, they found out that there were over 600 camps throughout Germany. So all those people in Germany knew what was going on.
Now you're into the soup.
Oh, can I ask a question?
Sure.
It may not exactly pertain, but I want to stick it in. We heard a talk about Sharia law.
Yes.
And the narrator wasn't very probing. She just giving an opportunity for the lady that was in favor of Sharia law present her points, but you didn't probe. And I thought, are there things that I should know about it that I don't know?
Yeah.
Like how they feel about female mutilation.
Of course.
All right?
Yeah.
She didn't ask that.
Yeah. No, and that's, I'm glad you asked that question, and it's related to a bigger question and a sensitive area. Sometimes in talking about Islam and Muslims, when the point of what you're trying to do in your talk is to struggle against hate and struggle against Islamophobia, there's a tendency to idealize Islam and Muslims in a way that it would be just as stupid to do that as about Christianity and Christians. In other words, or Judaism and, you know, I mean, let's face it, the guy who killed the Prime Minister of Israel was a Jew, and he did it for what he believed were deeply important Jewish reasons. When Franklin Graham said the Iraq invasion was based on Christian things, he believed that. So the idea that somehow everything is all right with Islamic teaching or all right with all Muslims, just not true. And I worry sometimes when I hear people whose good intention is to respond to hate, respond to bias, then trying to sell a version of Islam that is so clearly good that no one could possibly interpret anything in it in a bad way. Sorry, not true any more about Islam than Judaism or Christianity. And that's, as a Christian, it's important for me to say that. It isn't somehow that Islam has wrinkles in it or the texts have expressions in the text that can be misinterpreted, and somehow ours don't have any of that. So, you know, genital mutilation. The almost universal position of Muslim teachers and scholars is against female genital mutilation. It still happens. And interesting, it happens in some communities where Christians also believe in it. So in that sense, it has a cultural aspect to it, not just a religious aspect, or not just a religious basis. Go ahead, you were going to say something. Or maybe you weren't.
Yeah, so one of the things I find, so I made the comment about Fox News.
Yes.
Because one of the tough things about it is if I listen to it long enough,
yes,
I feel myself start to get, you know, polarized.
Yeah.
And you.
You mean against it, or you begin to absorb it?
No. I don't absorb that. Okay. But you just get more and more angry.
Okay.
The more you listen to it, and then the right. more angry you get, the less listening you get, and the
yeah,
less patient.
Yeah.
Hearing anything that sounds like it,
yeah,
right? You get
yes.
you become intolerant of it yourself.
Yes.
So on one hand, you're trying to hold a boundary.
Yes.
But if you hold that boundary, it's you can't listen anymore.
Yeah, it's
and
interesting.
So,
yeah.
Right? And so one of the things I find hard, like you were saying, people don't engage.
Yeah.
It's that own your own struggle.
Yeah.
Like most people will find it very hard to deal with their own emotions
yeah.
around it so that you can still be act functionally like you did with that Armenian to,
yeah.
to get at the heart of the matter,
right?
And so what would you say is a good way to kind of intervene? I mean, do you hold a listening space and let all of this stuff go out because you think they need to vent? Because sometimes you need to let the pus out, but another time you think they're just you know what
no,
I mean?
It's a tough question. I don't think there's any simple answer. It is a process. I think one of the things that I find about myself, and I oftentimes find it out in a way that I'm critical of myself, is that when I'm more relaxed, I mean, that's a funny word to use because it isn't like just getting up from a nap or something. It's something a little deeper than that when I say relax. When I'm centered
yes.
in a way that, for instance, Quakers talk about and the process of centering, when I'm centered, and I think the process of centering means centered in something other than my ego, something more grace-filled. When I'm feeling that way, and it one way to say it is relaxed, I can engage better with a person who has a very sharply different point of view than mine, more so than when I'm feeling a little like this that I've got to sort of compete with and make my scores, you know, score my arguments. And then part of it is a matter of luck. I mean, I think this Armenian fellow and I both, part of our smile was we didn't expect to be where we were at the end of the conversation. It came as a bit of a surprise to both of us. So luck is involved. You know, you're sort of like, you know, panning for gold, and sometimes it's just rocks that you find in the water, and other times there's a glimmer of something more valuable. But why did it happen? Well, maybe it had something to do with how he was and how I was, and maybe it had something to do with accidental encounter. It's a tough question, and it's a tough question, and it, you know, we live in very difficult times in our country in that respect. Very difficult times. Because it is pretty damn easy to feel right. And I would say even too easy. Too easy. I don't know.
When we were talking about hate crimes.
Yeah.
I haven't had an experience of this, but I've talked to people who work with people who, in terms of de-escalation.
Okay.
So one of the things that I think is really important is that you don't try to combat a combative situation unless you have skills about in de-escalating.
Yeah.
Um, but that you companion the person who has been victimized. And you can do that.
Who has been victimized.
And has been victimized. Mm. You can do that if they want to accept that.
Yeah.
But there's a way of not getting in the way of the fire or escalating,
right.
But then sitting with, companioning, looking
yeah,
out
yeah.
with that person.
Yes, yes, yes.
And staying with them and
yeah.
asking, and staying with them, walking with them, seeing
The whole accompaniment idea, which Lutherans have been engaged in on the West Bank, for instance, with Palestinians under occupation and walking Palestinian school kids to school where you need to go past a Jewish settlement that's hostile.
That's a very active, unpassive way.
It's easier when you find the person who is and feels victimized to be likable.
Well, right.
In other words, you've also experienced arguments or encounters with persons who are very fearful of Islam. And in a sense, they feel like victims already of Islam. and you don't particularly cotton to them. You wouldn't want to, invite one home. But you're encountering them. And then it's a little harder to do the companion thing.
You did that in a way with the man from Uncle Tio, because you stopped. Once you came to that smiling point.
Right, right. You left. That's true. Yeah, no, right. I didn't ask him if he's going to get out of this group, and not go to any more meetings.
You didn't push him to get
right.
to know her.
Right. No, you're right. You're right. That's true. That was, I'm glad I had an example that was positive. because I can give you, dozens of examples where I've encountered hatred or... And anti-Muslim feelings where I don't feel like anything positive really happened for either the person or myself. That's the way that goes. I mean, for instance, there's a fellow, and this, I gather, is part of Act for America. This is the group that was involved in this case, who goes around. He has this book called The Traveler. And it's a... And it's a big fat book, and he's got all these colored markers in it, and it's a book that looks at Quranic sayings and interpretations, and shows how awful they are. Now, one of the problems with the book is that it's from the 13th century, and as I tried to point out, not directly to him, because this book was it for him. He had all he needed. And he waved it, waving the Bible. What I pointed out to some person standing around that may or may not have helped to move them a little bit off their eight positions, is that if you took that particular time in Christianity, it was a period where, in the name of Christianity, all the Muslims and Jews were murdered in Jerusalem. By Christians, in the name of Christ. So, where does that leave us? It leaves us all, I think, thinking maybe we could do a little better now. Maybe we could do a little better than we did as Christians back then, or as Muslims in the interpretation being read from the traveler from the 13th century. But it's hard. It's no easy task. The other thing about it that I want to point out before we look at what can be done about Islamophobia is to make us all aware, if we're not aware, that this is an industry. Hate for Muslims is not a volunteer project. In fact, it's a $206 billion a year. I may have said billion, maybe it's million, but it's impressive in any case. $206 million a year industry involving a number of national organizations and local organizations funded by that amount of money. That's the amount of money they raised and spent, I think, in 2015 or 2016. The group that I'm talking about, Act for America, $52 million. So we're not talking here about some person you meet on, we may be talking also about a person you meet on the street who doesn't have any connection with any organization, but the Islamophobia campaign which has reached into state legislatures and county governments and national legislatures, members of Congress, and is mobilizing people around, for instance, protecting America from Sharia law. And I mean, it would be hard, I think, maybe impossible, to find an American Muslim who believes that part of what Islam wants to do is make Sharia law the law of America. I mean, one little piece of Sharia law, for instance, regarding marriage and divorce, just as in some Jewish communities, that's handled within the community according to Jewish teachings, there might be a wish that some of that could be handled that way. And in fact, the U.S. court said in a particular case, I don't have the number, said, yes, that can happen that way. In other words, there's nothing contradictory about working out a divorce agreement based on Sharia. There's nothing contradictory with that with U.S. law. But that's a small example. What the Act for America is saying, that Muslims want Sharia to be the law of the land. And when you get into what is Sharia, well, the closest thing I know to it, in Christian terms, it is the way. The way. You know how we say Jesus is the way? Well, Jesus is the path. Sharia is the path. In other words, Sharia has in it the teachings that can help us live a good life. But the idea in this country that American Muslims want Sharia to replace American law is just so far-fetched. But trying to convince someone who's convinced in the opposite direction of that is hard. And sadly, I mean, there's been progress made by these anti-Sharia efforts in getting state legislatures to pass laws that prevent Sharia from taking over the legislature. Well, I mean, you know, you get a law passed, it's a newspaper headline, people read, that's good. Glad for that, you know. But it plays in, of course, to thick biases about Islam. I mentioned Act for America. I mentioned it because it's one of the largest well-funded, I said 50 million out of the 206 million. It's got more than 1,000 local chapters, over, I think, 350,000 members. It has doubled the number of chapters, Act for America, in Washington State just in the last year or so. And it sponsored the anti-Muslim, anti-Sharia, anti-female genitalia business on June 10 of this year across the country. Small demonstration in Seattle brought out a much larger counter-demonstration, which was, and in Portland, Oregon. There are a number of organizations, and I'll just cite them here. Some of them may be, their emails may be in what you've given, but I don't think so. One of the most important national organizations countering Islamophobia is, and this is its email address, Shoulder to Shoulder Campaign. Shoulder to Shoulder Campaign, and it's important to include the word campaign, because when I looked up Shoulder to Shoulder, there's something cooperative effort in regard to Peru or Ecuador, that's also shoulder to shoulder. But shouldertoshouldercampaign.org. And then CAIR, C-A-I-R, and you can look up CAIR Seattle if you're in this area, but or CAIR nationally, CAIR.org, C-A-I-R, and it stands for Council of American Islamic Relations, C-A-I-R.org. And then two, in this area, Washington area, the Faith Action Network, which actually Carol, my wife, is the co-founder and co-chair of, which is growing in the number of congregations involved, and it's Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, Sikh. I'm trying to think if there are other groups that are involved, but religious traditions involved. It has a number of congregations that support it. It has a network of individuals. It does a yearly lobbying thing in Olympia. And this issue of Islamophobia is one of the things that the Faith Action Network addresses. And then an organization that is in this area that specifically addresses that is called Neighbors in Faith. And a pastor named Terry Kylo, K-Y-L-O, I think it's K-Y-L-O, Terry Kylo is involved in that, and that that's really focused entirely on this issue. Well, what I thought we would do now is take the next to the last page in the handout, which is a list of, well, it's combating Islamophobia, and it's an action and resource list. And just, well, I'd like to just go down it with you, and I'll, ones that I put checks next to are ones that I know, and I'm not saying therefore they're the best, because ones that I don't know may be better. But these I feel comfortable saying, yes, take a look at that. My first X is next to the second thing on the list there. Check out Islamic Fact. And you have a copy of that in the packet. I think it's one of the first things in your packet. And the really interesting thing about that, it was prepared by CARE, so people might say, oh, well, it's prepared by Muslims, it's biased. With each of the questions and fact checks, if you go to the website, you'll find resources that are much deeper and more, what should I say, objective than a Muslim organization saying this is what's true. That is based on studies that have been done, based on polls that have been done, based on a lot of research from other sources. In other words, the sources for the Islam fact check are not just all CARE. They go much deeper than that. So I recommend that. I recommend it as a site to look at. Islamic Fact Check, islamfactcheck.org. And then the next one I checked is to attend talks and events to learn more about Islam and Islamophobia. Obviously, those are things that, you know, the things you can read, there are things you can get. In this area, again, I would recommend Neighbors in Faith, and Terry does visits to local churches that are really terrific and oftentimes is able to combine a mosque and a church in some kind of an educational event. And then, you know, visit a mosque. And there, I would say it's not just individuals, partly because mosques can become overburdened by individuals coming and wanting to learn more about Islam. So a congregation, though, deciding that as a congregation, we're going to approach a mosque in our area and say, could we come to visit you sometime? And would you come to our church to visit? And that kind of thing has been happening. It's happening more. It's a good thing. It can happen. It still can happen much more. And then learning about the Islamophobia Network, that's certainly worthwhile. Because, as I said, I think sometimes we think, oh, I met this weird guy who was anti-Islam. And then you find out that he's a representative of an organization that has a $52 million budget. Well, that's different than just I met a guy. Oh, and then the last one in that first list, check out the Southern Poverty Law Center. Some of you may be familiar with that because from civil rights days and race issues. I mean, this is a group that's been going for a long time that keeps tabs on our worst instincts, if you will. I mean, in regard to racism and so forth. And now, including on anti-Muslim stuff. And if you go to their website, in fact, they have a long thing about Act for America, which I think I included in your packet, but you can get it directly from their website. Moving down to the next section, meet Muslims. Well, you know, I say here, you know, obviously you can do neighbors and individuals, but you also can do congregational meetings, which I think makes sense because you begin to develop not just individual relationships, but relationships of more people with more people. And the third, be an active ally. Look for opportunities to provide support. Well, publicly and vocally welcome Muslims as your neighbors. I don't know how many of you, our church in Everett did a simple thing. We put up a banner that welcome Muslim neighbors, and then we put up a sign and had things in our bulletin about not welcoming, but sort of honoring Ramadan when Muslims began to fast. So we made or helped our congregation be aware that Muslims were fasting. And just so you can do those kind of things on your building, you can do, they're simple things, but they matter. Because, I mean, I remember Carol Jensen, my wife, pastor at St. John United, put a thing up on their signboard, I think maybe it was about Ramadan, but I'm not sure, and my goodness, she got a flood of emails and calls at the church by Muslims, saying thank you so much that they were heartened, they were encouraged by the sign. They didn't expect to see it, for one thing. You go by a Christian church and you expect to see, you know, something about Jesus or something about Easter, but here was something about Ramadan and something about Muslims. And it was a, you know, it's a very simple thing, but it's a, in these times, it is a countering of an atmosphere and of a sort of cloud that now is on us. Show up with signs of support when you hear mosque protests. I mean, look, we've been MAPS, which is the largest mosque in the Seattle area, out in Redmond. Twice, their big sign out in front, which is a kind of stone with words on it, carved words, has been vandalized. Well, people showed up there, and interestingly enough, and this relates to your reference to the Holocaust, when they had a big event with rededicating a new sign after the one had been vandalized, they had an event at the mosque. Hundreds of people showed up from churches and from synagogues. We joked that it seemed that, from what we knew, it seemed as if almost every rabbi from the Seattle area was there. While there were a number of Christians there, proportionately, the number of rabbis there were way, way outstripped the number of Christian clergy. And the reason was pretty clear. You don't have to talk long to a Jew to get them to understand what hate crimes mean. They know that history well. They know that history well. So rabbis turned out in strength at the beginning. And of course it was great. It was great. There was a great Muslim speaker whom I've known because of my work on Israel-Palestine, who had come from Washington, D.C. And it was just a great evening and event. And there were a good number of Lutheran and other pastors there, but proportionally, if Christian clergy had turned out in the proportion that the rabbis turned out, there would have been hundreds of Christian clergy there. There were dozens. Speak out when you hear someone harassed or attacked. Well, that's that sort of incident, you know, the guys on the train. I'm sure they didn't intend when they got on the train to get involved in a scene like that, let alone get killed. But they responded in a moment in a way that got them killed.
They were Buddhists.
Oh, and they were Buddhists. Yeah. Well, I make a joke when I talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Muslims and the Christians and Jews who all, you know, have systems of thought and so forth. And I've said, maybe what we need is some Buddhism in this conflict. Get everybody to relax and realize that what we don't know is more important than what we do. You know, not knowing in Buddhism is a value, you know? It's a value. Where I think Christians, Jews, and Muslims, knowing, we know the truth. We've got it. He's it. We are, you know, da-da. All right, next thing, use of power of your pen. Well, you know, some are inclined, some aren't, but to write a letter to the paper, it is effective. People read the papers, and so something happens in your community or something national of some importance that you know about, that people have heard about, so you write a letter. Obviously, if you're more ambitious, you try to write an op-ed piece. And then personal conversation, group discussions, blogs, social media. You know, it's interesting that when I asked if any of us had experienced an incident of hate or abuse, no one raised, we didn't raise our hands, but I mean, you may experience it, and so try to be ready in the sense of, well, I don't know if you can try to be ready, but this is just sort of, just our talking about it might make you alert to something that you see or hear in whatever context, where you might say, wait a minute, do you really think that that's, you know, or whatever way you might try to intervene to make the situation open up a little bit. Turning over, stand up for those being physically or verbally attacked. Well, and the last phrase in that sentence is probably the real key to the whole idea. Don't leave it to the victims to respond, you know? I mean, what is the whole thing about Black Lives Matter today and whites insisting on wearing those t-shirts? It's saying, I'm not going to leave it all to blacks to say how racism still exists and what happens as a result of racism. I, as a white, am going to wear that banner. I'm going to say, you know, of course all lives matter. You know, don't give me that. I'm wearing this to make a statement that blacks don't have to make these statements only by themselves. And that's what it is for Muslims. Of course, Jews and Christians matter, but I'm wearing this t-shirt because Muslims are under attack. And therefore, I, as a non-Muslim, want to stand with and not just leave it to them to have to respond. It's a, boy, I mean, if that doesn't relate to basic Holocaust teaching, I don't know what does.
So you're going to make some Muslim Lives Matter t-shirts?
Well, you know. The problem with it in our day is it would be seen in some context as somehow taking away from Black Lives Matter. Yeah. And I'm not going to play that game if I can avoid it. I've been in situations where I've trapped myself into, you know, getting into that situation, and it's not really very helpful. It's not really very helpful. And I think, having worked at a black church in Memphis, and I mean, that was a long time ago, but I think I at least have one antenna that picks up why blacks are sensitive to that issue of somebody else coming along and trying to put them in there instead, you know. Muslims, all lives, et cetera, et cetera. So, no, I don't think. And anyway, if you've ever seen my handwriting, you wouldn't want me to make a t-shirt. Look for and build solidarity movements. Well, obviously, these are community issues, not just individual issues. And therefore, joining some action neighborhood committee, being supportive of, for instance, Neighbors in Faith, the one I mentioned, Terry Kylo, or the Faith Action Network that I mentioned that Carol's very much involved in. Then a couple down, have your church, synagogue, temple, company, or other entity post or display a Muslim solidarity sign. Yeah, well, that's why I said, you know, it's neat that a church has a banner saying, welcome Muslim neighbors. It's a, you know, it's obviously a message that 10 years ago no church would have thought to put up. And it's a message in this time that has relevance. It has traction, not just for Muslims, but for other Christians. For Christians going by, probably more Christians will see it than Muslims, and they'll say, "What?" And they'll think for a minute, and they'll say, "Well, that's a church, yeah, I guess, you know, right?" I mean, get and wear a "Hate Has No Place Here." There are good T-shirts. You can find a T-shirt somewhere, I'm sure. A button, a t-shirt, and then, you know, those are simple things. I know, you know, I remember at the early days of Vietnam, people said, well, I'm against the war, but I'm not going to carry a sign. Or I'm against the war, but I'm not going to wear a button. Somehow, I don't know, they thought like doing something like wearing a button or a shirt made you into a different kind of animal, you know? Now, the positive thing is they may have thought, I'd rather be surprise somebody with my views than advertising it before I even met them. So there's some value in just wearing a regular shirt and not being anti-Muslim, rather than having a big shirt that says, anyway, so, you know, sort of like underground. You're a little bit underground, you know? Yeah.
I've seen some signs around Seattle that people put in front of their houses.
Yes.
They're about this big, and they're written in different colored letters.
Okay.
And basically it's kind of saying, in this house we act with kindness, we are welcome. Okay. And it's a whole series of signs.
Well, I was to a coffee shop that had that sign, and I asked them, is this only your sign? This was in Seattle, and they said, no, there's some effort about these. Well, the woman serving the coffee didn't know where it come from, but she knew it wasn't just their sign.
Yeah,
I saw. Yeah. There's
Minneapolis
too. And okay, so if anybody knows a website or something.
Can I insert, in Everett, there's a group that the first Sunday of every month,
yes,
they march in solidarity with immigrants and refugees.
Yes.
And they have signage that in three languages says, We're glad you are in there, no matter from where you come.
I see, lovely.
They have
lovely.
That sign,
Similar, yeah.
Sentiment.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess I would just say in these days, those simple acts are not at all unnecessary. They're not at all sort of, you know, I don't know, over the top or something. They are right where we need to be in terms of expressions in our communities. Yeah.
Well, and there's something about that kind of activity that generates collective sentiment.
Yes.
And it's hard to avoid.
Yes.
And people generalize on the basis of it.
Yes.
And when they see those signs popping up, and,
yeah.
and there's research on this. I mean, people have documented this.
Yes.
And people start thinking different things about their neighbors.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. And that's very, very important, because many people, maybe the vast majority, don't often or ever think about these issues. So a sign like that on a church or a sign like that on a yard causes a think. and oftentimes the think goes positive, is positive. That is to say, oh, that's a good thought. That's a positive thing. And that's a lot accomplished. I think it's a lot accomplished, particularly as you say, it begins to become community-wide, and so don't minimize that. Donate your time and money. Well, there we always come around to that. But volunteering is really important. Volunteering with care, volunteering with Neighbors in Faith, volunteering with Faith Action Network, contributing money. I don't know if you heard, but American Civil Liberties Union, they're having trouble fundraising now, because when Trump was elected, they had a flood of funds come in. I mean, more came in, I think, in a week than they normally collected in a year. And so when they call you now, they say, you can say, I know, you got a lot of money. They still, obviously, they need money, but my point is that there was a response by people who gave to ACLU that had never given before, or had given and never given three times as much as they did in the context of Trump's election. Okay, and then the last paragraph there, get and stay involved politically. I mean, these are not issues or things that are gonna be settled in one anything. Neither one election, neither one demonstration, neither one posting of signs, and therefore, contacting our representatives is important on a basis, and you know, exploring what is it that, asking them maybe what they have done already. I mean, in the case of Congressman Larson, we were very pleased that he both wrote a piece in the wrote a column in the paper, and then met with Muslim community about the building of the mosque, and said, you know, how basically American that was, and the idea that it would be blocked was just ridiculous in his view. And he came out strong. The mayor of Mukilteo, a woman, made her a strong statement. So those are important things. And obviously, being politicians, they're getting phone calls and letters either encouraging them to do that or appreciating that they did that. It's very important. It's basic to how politics works. And you can't just wait for the next election, which I think one of the most encouraging things that I've heard from many individuals since the election is, you know, I never used to do anything political except vote, and now I'm getting involved. Now I'm getting active. Well, boy, there's a lesson in democracy that we all might have learned a little earlier, but whatever we learn, it's valuable, that you need to be engaged not just at election time, but all the time, or a lot of the time. Except when you're at Holden, where you get your oats to go back and be engaged. The specific there, second one down, urge your representatives to support the No Religious Registry Act. You know, there's talk by Bannon, one of Trump's key advisors, and by Trump, the idea of setting up a Muslim registry where all American Muslims would have to register. Well, if that doesn't sound like the World War II and the Japanese community, I don't know what does. And I think we out here in this part of the world who were involved or not involved in the Japanese internment understand that and understand the analogy. So we have a voice on that that has a relationship with things that have already, that did terrible things that happened and were done to a community here. But even if you're not, I think a lot of Americans understand the idea of the government setting up a requirement that Muslims register is, you know, should not happen. And there is now legislation in the House and Senate anti the idea of a religious registry, and that's something worth supporting. You know, I kept one little story. I think we're near time here, but I months, probably maybe as long as a year or 18 months after 9/11 happened, I spoke at a United Church of Christ church congregation in Florida on the Israeli-Palestinian thing, probably. I mean, I think that's what it was. And a man came up to me afterward, and he said, could I talk with you privately? And I said, sure. So we went to the side, and he said, I work for the FBI. I said, oh, that's interesting, you know. And something had come up about 9/11 and Muslims, because there was a major sweep in Florida, partly because that's where some of the terrorists had done their avionics training. So there was a whole sweep in Florida of the Muslim communities, and hundreds of American Muslims were arrested and held. Arrested and held, not just arrested, but held without any trial or anything, 4 months. Well, this FBI fellow said to me, he said, I'm really scared. I said, what are you scared about? He said, and then he told about the hundreds of Muslims. And he said, my impression, because I was involved in this, is that probably all of the people we arrested have nothing to do with terrorism. And if any do, it's like 2% out of the hundreds that were arrested and still being held. They were being held at that point. He said, and I said, what are you scared about? He said, I'm scared that when they get out, they may be interested in terrorism.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that we would have created our own enemies by trying to find enemies to blame what had happened on. And I thought to myself, oh my God, you know, and here's this FBI guy. Of course, he was talking in confidence. This is not something he publicly, although maybe he should have. He was protesting. And by the way, the case involving those Muslims is still not, but is about to reach the Supreme Court. But you were talking, you see what we're talking, 2001 to 2017, and the case is about whether the government has responsibility for some, and did wrong, that is, in a way that violated the Constitution, first of all, arrested and held these hundreds of people, maybe it was more than, you know, several hundred, and number two, does the government owe compensation of any sort to them for this violation of their constitutional rights? Well, it's a basic kind of case. Everybody, all of us in this room, can understand what the case is about. But it has taken from 2001 till 2017 to work its way, and I think it's on the court docket in the fall. And I thought to myself, oh dear, you know, in this sense, it's like climate change. We do certain things, but the effects of them may not be felt immediately. But they'll be felt. They'll be felt. And when they're things that hurt people, the hurts sometimes come back to hurt the hurters. And the hurters oftentimes are neutral about the hurting process. That is to say, we weren't directly involved in arresting all those Muslims, any of us.
Nor did we know about it.
Well, didn't is a question. I mean, there was news about it, but in the atmosphere of post 9/11, you know, certain things we may have said, ooh, that's awful, or we may have said, gee, I don't know about that. But then, after 9/11, you know, so I'm saying, but the climate change, I mean, you may seem strange to bring in climate change, but I think it is true about much wrong that we do, whether to people or to the earth or to the universe, to the system, that the results, the harm done, doesn't come to pay back for a long time. But it comes. And let me end on a little different note, though not necessarily a more encouraging one. One of the next to the last article in your packet is an article about how Muslim women by these hate groups and anti-Muslim groups are treated both as villains and victims. That is to say, they're treated as victims in the sense that they can't drive cars in Saudi Arabia, to put it mildly. Or they're treated as victims that in some places there is mutilation of genitals of women, young women. So they're treated as victims, and Islam has victimized them, but then they're treated as villains also. If they're wearing Sharia, they become an object to hate. So what a dual burden for Muslim women, that they're both talked about as they're victimized by religion and then talked about as if they are villains that we have to be afraid of and fight. I'll just leave it up here and you can pick it up. There's a very moving story from Sterling, Virginia, about how, and I don't know enough Muslim women to have said, I know several women for whom this is true, but the woman who's writing the story tells about how she's lived in six cities, and during Ramadan, where you know that the fasting begins at the first light, when you can tell the difference between a black thread and a white thread, so it's not even sunrise, but first light, how in every city she's lived in, a ritual for her friends, men and women, Muslims, was to go to IHOP, which is open 24 hours a day, to have breakfast just before first light. And usually when they went, there were other non-Muslims there who were getting over partying the night before, who also were at IHOP. So there's these two groups with different sort of orientation. And she said there was always a guy among the Muslims who really worked at making sure everybody drank enough water before they went off. Because, you know, the fasting in Ramadan is no liquids, not just no food. So and she's remembering this and saying it was almost like a party for Muslims in the sense that you could count on if you went to IHOP, wherever you were, in six cities she had lived, there'd be Muslims there. Because it was open 24 hours, you could get a good breakfast, you could get plenty of water, and you could then go off to work or school or whatever it was. Well, in Sterling, Virginia, just 3 weeks ago, during Ramadan, a young woman was returning from IHOP and was attacked and killed. And the police have determined it was a case of road rage, which is highly suspicious to me as a determination. But the woman writing the article said she wasn't sure, as Muslim women and Muslims generally became aware of that incident where this woman was killed, that IHOP, the IHOP experience would ever be the same. So I leave you with that thought, that, you know, we're, this isn't abstract, the business of my Muslim neighbors. It isn't abstract at all. It's about people we know, some of us, and people we don't know, but could get to know. And it is, it will be how this story moves forward about Muslims in America and American non-Muslims and Muslims, how this story moves forward, because we're not at the beginning of it and we're not certainly at the end of it, how this story moves forward over the next 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 years will be one of the determinants of whether this country is better or not. I have no doubt about that. That's not a bad way to leave these sessions on the Middle East, Israel, Palestine. Yes.
Do you ever lead a session on the historicity of the person of Muhammad? It isn't that long ago that he lived. We can know a lot about the history of the person, his personality and personality.
There are great, just let me mention two or three biographies. I've not led a session on this, but Karen Armstrong, whose name some of you know from other books she's written, she has a biography of the Prophet that's excellent. Effie Peters has a biography of the Prophet. look up biography of the prophet. Those two are ones that I have read and I think are scholarly respected, because that's part of the story. You know, you don't want to make up the story of Muhammad. You want to tell it as much as you can based on historical evidence. Yeah.
Another one, Dr. Alvin Schmidt.
Okay.
Alvin Schmidt.
Okay.
Sociologist from Northwestern University.
Okay.
Has done one.
A biography.
A biography type thing as researching his background.
Good. It's marvelous because, you know, obviously we know something about the life of Jesus. And there's been a lot written about that. It's good to learn something about the life of Muhammad. Yes?
Well, one thing about knowing someone who's Muslim.
Yes.
Well, anyway, in Los Alamos, where I live, New Mexico.
Yes.
There was a young Muslim couple from India.
Okay.
Anyway, he was working at the laboratory.
Okay.
And she had finished some schooling.
Yeah.
That was in Finland, actually. She had to finish her paper for, you know, requirements for her degree.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, the language wasn't the best for them.
Okay.
So my wife and I agreed to edit her language, her sentences, not the content.
No, I understand.
But the sentences for her paper.
Yes.
So she could finish her requirements for a degree.
Okay.
And we did that.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, they also they had a small son.
Right.
But they also had twins during this time we were working together. And we had them at our house.
Yes.
And we were invited to their home for a while.
Yeah.
And anyway, when the twins were there, of course, he went off to, we have an ashram in New Mexico, run by Sufis.
Okay.
And he went up there and sacrificed three goats.
Okay.
Two for the son, one for the daughter.
Okay.
Anyway, it became a dinner at the at a house they were using in Santa Fe for a mosque.
Okay.
The group.
Right.
And we were invited to this dinner.
Right.
At the mosque for right. One of them, and I went there, and it was very nice. And then they had a several-hour prayer meeting. We weren't required to go to that. We said we could be excused if we wanted, or we could come if we wanted.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway.
Well,
I'm saying here.
Yeah.
Posters are wonder. They're just fine, I guess. T-shirts are okay. But it has nothing to do with being part of someone's
life.
Life. Right.
Yeah. No. I mean, you're ending on the note which I began with, or next to the beginning, where I said, knowing about Islam. And knowing that it's wrong to treat people in prejudiced, stereotypical ways, negative ways, is really important. But knowing Muslims,
yeah.
That's what really, I mean,
and
your story.
They invited to their,
Yeah, exactly. No. You're right on target. Well, thank you. It's been great having these times together.